Brothers, a Clark Ashton Smith podcast.
It was in the fall of 1947, 3 days prior to the annual football game between Stanford and the University of California, that the strange visitor from outer space landed in the middle of the huge stadium at Berkeley, where the game was to be held. Descending with peculiar deliberation, it was seen and pointed out by multitudes of people in the town that border on San Francisco Bay and Berkeley, Oakland, Alameda, and San Francisco itself. Gleaming with a fiery, copperish golden light, it floated down from the cloudless autumn azure, dropping in a sort of slow spiral above the stadium. It was utterly unlike any known type of aircraft, and was nearly 100 feet in length. The general shape was ovoid, and also more or less angular, with a surface divided into scores of variant planes, and with many diamond ports of purplish material different from that of which the body was constructed. Even at first glance, it suggested the inventive genius and workmanship of some alien world, of a people whose ideas of mechanical symmetry have been conditioned by evolutional necessities and sense faculties divergent from ours.
Greetings, friends, and thank you for joining us today for Season 3, Episode 5 of Strange Shadows, the Clark Ashton Smith podcast. The voice you just heard was author, broadcaster, and journalist Peter Laws, reading the opening paragraph of today's story. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Poynton.
And I'm the other one, Tim Mendes. Yeah, today we're going to be looking at a little bit of an anomaly in the Smithian oeuvre. We're going to be looking at the seedling of Mars.
Yes, it's a science fiction story, but quite an unusual genesis, this one, as we'll find out with the publication history.
Yeah.
And I think we both agree that this type of science fiction story from Smith, probably not our favourites.
No. But it's still better than most of the other stuff in the genre.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's still those little moments of sublimeness, Smithian sublimeness, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So shall we start with our favourite words then?
Indeed. Yeah, I got a couple out of this one. I think probably my absolute favourite was pileated, which means membranous or membrane-like covering.
Ah, I had trouble with that because the only reference I could find was to woodpeckers.
A woodpecker. Yeah.
Like a crest on the head sort of thing. I was trying to associate that with couches, but you found that meaning as well. Excellent.
Yeah, it's an archaic meaning. It's one that's fallen out of use. But I had to do a bit of a deep dive in the Oxford Dictionary website sort of thing to find out the old usages of it. So there you go.
Nice. My first choice is a word that I knew, but I just like the sound of it. And in fact, these two words together, telluric metallurgy. And telluric, of course, means just of the earth.
Nice. My next one is peroration. There you go. I think that's how you pronounce it, which is the concluding part of a speech.
Very nice. There was one that I wasn't familiar with, inchoate, which just means not fully formed. I must have seen that word before. It sounds like a very weird towels kind of word, but it didn't ring any bells. So inchoate.
Yeah, I've seen it before, but I actually looked it up because it's one of them words that I've inferred the meaning of in the way it's used, because I've seen it, I've read it in quite
a lot. I'm sure Lovecraft has used it.
Yeah, Lovecraft and people like that. But basically not fully formed or rudimentary.
Yeah.
My final one is probably promulgated, which is another one that I've been inferred the meaning of for years, which basically means to make widely known.
One I had to look up was refection, not reflection, refection, which simply means refreshment or a light meal. And my last choice, ultra sensational, because that brought so many connotations to me. It reminded me, first of all, of Clockwork Orange with the old ultraviolence.
Indeed, yeah. Zig Sputnik. It's a very Zig Sputnik word, isn't it? Ultra sensational.
Yes. But I was also thinking a sort of Tony Blackburn.
Smashy and Nicey.
Smashy and Nicey, wasn't it? That's ultra sensational, mate.
Absolutely.
So ultra sensational. I mean, it means exactly what it sounds like. It's a good word.
So,
some good words there, but not really the baroqueness that we usually associate with Smith. Again, maybe because we're in that science fiction genre.
But maybe
you could tell us about this, how this story came about then. So you say it's quite an interesting one, this.
Yeah, like I say, it's quite an anomaly. And I think you're right to bring that up, because basically Smith was working to order here. Hugo Gernsback and David Lasser from Wonder Stories came up with, admittedly, quite a cool idea to increase readership. This is a contest whereby readers would send in a plot synopsis and the winners would see their story written by one of Wonder Stories' regular contributors. So they started this in the spring quarterly of Wonder Stories, because there was the monthly Wonder Stories and a quarterly. This was the spring issue. They basically put it out. In the summer one, they announced the winners. And then in the fall one, this story was printed. Mr. M. Johnson of Collingwood, Ontario, won second place with his story, The Martian. And none other than Mr. Clark Ashton Smith was chosen to write it. How cool would that be, right? Not only did you win, you also got a cash prize for winning. And Clark Ashton Smith is writing your story.
Wouldn't that be fantastic? I think we should, just thinking on that, if you knew that Clark Ashton Smith was going to write a story, what synopsis would you give him? What concepts would you pitch? Perhaps listeners could send some ideas in.
That's a really good idea. I'm going to have a think about that as well. It probably would have to be something really, really weird, wouldn't it? To get the most out of Smith's language, you know.
It'd have to be ultra sensational, mate.
Nice. So basically, Smith wrote the story in less than a week. He was told how long it needed to be. Here's your synopsis. Go off and write it. He completed it on July the 20th, 1931. Now, Lasser actually wrote to Smith about the brief. We have no objections of you revising the plots for the purpose of the story as long as the fundamental idea is retained, and we are perfectly willing to pay you our usual rate for your completed story. He was actually paid $118 for the story. So that's not a bad payday, if you think about it.
That must be one of his highest pay rates then.
Which is strange, really, considering that Gernsback was also paying competition winners. Well, if they ever got the money, you know, Hugo the Rat and all that.
There is that, isn't there?
Yeah. Smith actually did mention to Lovecraft, he just wrote that the plot was pretty good, so the job wasn't so disagreeable as it sounds.
Right.
So, you can imagine him like, what have I let myself in for agreeing to this? But, you know, pecuniary depletion being what it is.
Well played, sir.
Basically, the story was originally published under the title The Planet Entity. But Smith hated that. He didn't like it. So when it was reprinted in one of his collections, he reverted it to the story that the title he originally used, which is The Seedling from Mars. And that's basically how it's been known in every other reprint.
Right.
So there you go.
And I think, this is kind of in his wheelhouse when we think of stories like, is it Metamorphosis of the Earth? And
Immeasurable Horror.
That idea of some alien form taking over the whole planet, particularly they're either kind of Shoggothy or planty, aren't they, generally?
Yeah. It also, actually, the setup, while I was reading it, the beginning, the setup really reminded me of a Donald Wandry story, The Fire Vampires.
Right.
The setup of it, for some reason, I don't know why, it just sort of rang a bell. I think it may have been that one, or it may have been the one about the big proto-shoggothy things. I can't remember the name of it offhand, but it's a great story.
And I think here we're seeing the seeds.
See what you did there.
Yeah. Of that kind of later 50s UFO scare thing, the day the Earth stood still and
body snatchers.
Yeah, yeah.
I got major body snatchers vibes. That there's one scene sort of halfway through it where basically somebody comes out of a pod.
Right, right. And I suppose, to be fair, then we should harken back to H.G. Wells as well with War of the Worlds, of course, which was. Had quite a planty element, didn't it? Was it the red weed it was called or something?
Yeah, the red weed, yeah.
So, yeah, it is certainly in Smith's wheelhouse. And he does a good job of it, of course. But
Of course, yeah.
I did find it at 16,000 words. I found my attention wandering in places, which is very unusual for Smith.
Yeah, I did notice that there was quite a bit of repetition. But I guess he's been told, here's your plot. Here's how long you've got to do it. If you haven't got 16,000 words of plot, you're going to have to put a bit of filler in, right? Because there was a lot of repetition with the one guy, the scientist Stilton. He basically he keeps saying the same damn thing, and I didn't know whether it was an intentional thing or I don't know, but I just thought it was interesting because there's actually more dialogue in this than you usually get in a lot of Smith stories.
Yeah, and in a way, it's almost character-driven, isn't it? We've got these two protagonists who are sort of, well, they're in the same field, but they're in opposite corners of the field. Yeah.
It's like a forerunner to the Big Bang Theory, isn't it? It's like Leonard and Sheldon, isn't it?
So our story starts, as we heard, in 1947, and there's this football game. Of course, as Brits, then we think of something else.
Indeed. But
I'm sure that's American football. A university game between Stanford and the University of California. And we get this close encounter of, well, is this the second kind, I suppose, isn't it? The third kind is sort of personal contact, is it?
Yeah.
Isn't it? So this is a definite UFO sighting.
Yeah.
As the thing comes down and hovers over the football field.
Yeah, I like that. I do like this, the way that it sort of just appears and just plonks itself down in the middle of the football field. I can just picture everybody sort of standing around going, But what I really liked was the response, because the first response was,
Let's shoot it. And I like this thing, because we're in 1947, so what we're about sort of... 15 years in the future or something like that, which is not long in the future, but of course post World War II, which no one had seen coming at this point. And the initial thought is this is the harbinger of a long plotted attack from the Russian and Chinese Soviets. So even in the 1930s, there's this hint of that. I won't say McCarthyism, because I don't think Smith would have been that way inclined. But nonetheless, that's the first thought. It's the Soviets invading us.
Yeah. And he mentions after that, or even from Germany, whose intentions were still suspected. So obviously this is interwar when it was written. So it was incredibly forward thinking, really.
And of course, some other people think that this is an alien visitor, which is kind of confirmed when the trajectory of this thing is plotted, because it came... I think the phrase is translunar.
Yes.
And then speculation starts, well, if it's not of this Earth, then where did it come from? And they actually managed to plot the trajectory back to Mars.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a bit of a controversy reigned as whether it had come from Venus, Mars, Mercury, or one of the superior planets, or whether perhaps it was a wanderer from another solar system than our own. Yeah, so then, well, this is very true. It's a real life, isn't it? You get a bunch of well-learned scientific people in a room, and what they're going to do, they're going to argue about it for weeks until somebody proves, no, look, it came from Mars.
And I love this thing as well, as we've got all this sort of galactic speculation going on, but other people were really annoyed that it had interrupted the football game, and actually they get a petition up and send a petition in.
That is the human nature, isn't it? The first thing you try and do is shoot at it, and then you try and you just moan about it.
It stopped the football. You know, my world has come to an end.
Yeah. Could you imagine if it landed at Stamford Bridge or something on a Saturday? It's an outrage.
The great metallic hole, it was felt, no matter whence it had come or why, should not be allowed to interfere with anything so sacrosanct and of such prime importance as a football game. So we often say that Smith uses his science fiction stories to put in a bit of biting satire, don't we?
And yeah,
I think we certainly get that in this story.
Oh, there's quite a bit. That's something I did like about this story quite a lot, was the jabs he was throwing at various institutions and things like that. I thought that was quite fun.
And after this great dramatic opening, which I thought, again, is quite cinematic, and you see that a lot in films now, right? The trope is people look up and there's this huge craft above New York or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But nothing happens. This thing just sits there, nothing moves, nothing happens. Oh, of course, it's ringed. The Marines are called in, aren't they? And we get all the machine guns trained on it.
You've got a couple of bombers on standby as well, ready to scramble. Yeah.
I love that stuff where you have this sort of craft that's traveled through the interstellar gulfs and the asteroid belt and all that, and you think you're going to do anything to it with a machine gun.
Well, it was like, I can't remember which one it was, but it was another one of Smith's science fiction ones where you had this battle going on, and the protagonist's first idea was to pull out his revolver and shoot at it. It was a big metal thing. It's like, yeah.
Well, it's just what a chap in tweed would do.
Exactly. There's a lot of tweed in this, isn't there?
Oh, speaking of which, shall we introduce our two protagonists?
Indeed.
Among the fortunate savants who had been selected was John Gallard, assistant astronomer at the Mount Wilson Observatory. Gallard represented the more radical and freely speculative trend of scientific thought and had become well known for his theories concerning the inhabitability of the inferior planets, particularly Mars and Venus. He had long championed the idea of intelligent and highly organized life on these worlds. So he's fully on board with this being, you know, not of this earth, probably crafted by intelligent aliens and so on.
Yeah, I'm picturing him as your sort of Quatermassy type chap.
Right, right.
So, you know, in the 50s, BBC, I'm seeing him like that, you know, with the tweed and the slightly messed up hair kind of thing, right?
And in the opposing corner, we have Godfrey Stilton, professor of astronomy at the University of California. So he's the big cheese, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Couldn't resist. Also on the committee might have been chosen as the very antithesis of Gallard in his views and tendencies. Narrow, dogmatic, sceptical of all that could not be proved by line and rule, scornful of all that lay beyond the bourne of a straight empiricism. So this guy is denying everything right up to the very end, even till his last dying breath, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. He's the very definition of one of those closed-minded scientific types that it's so common in fiction that it's a trope now, isn't it? They're so focused on their facts and their beliefs that anything else, no, it couldn't possibly be.
Yeah. It's complete denial, even when there's absolute proof of this stuff.
Look, there's a spaceship in the middle of a football field. No, it's not a spaceship.
And in on this committee as well, there's other various important people. There's some journalists. There's the mayor. There's the police chief. It's kind of your very typical sort of American town thing, isn't it? The committee that's put together is, I think there's 40 men.
Yeah.
Of course, no women. There's also a number of expert machinists equipped with acetylene torches. Again, like they're going to be able to cut into this thing.
Yeah. And it's the thing, it's like, almost like a Rotary Club or something, isn't it? It's local business owners and dignitaries. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, what's the first thing you do is you form a committee, right?
Exactly.
Probably to discuss what sort of committee you should have.
Committee you need, yeah. Yeah. And then nothing gets done. Call me cynical.
And in fact, nothing really does get done because everyone is in doubt as to what should be done. It seemed evident that the occupants of the vessel, if alive and conscious, were in no hurry to reveal themselves to human scrutiny. So you can imagine they're sort of standing around this thing. Someone's probably kicking it, right? Nothing's happening. Someone's knocked on it. Someone's taking photographs, I imagine, or measuring it or something.
Yeah.
So they decide to let the mechanics in with their acetylene torches to see if they can cut it open.
It does remind me of like the opening episode of a lot of like 70s Doctor Who with John Pertwee. Like the Claws of Axos is a great example where this thing lands. And yeah, the first thing they do is shoot it. No, that didn't work. Right. Hit it with a hammer. No, that didn't work. Get the chainsaw.
Let's try dynamite.
Yeah, dynamite.
But whether this threat or this action prompts the inhabitants of the craft to do something or whether they were going to do it anyway, it's just coincidence. We get a doorway open. And this is where we get, this is what again became a very nice science fiction trope.
Yeah.
It's like the strange door, and then you get this sort of ramp slides down. These sort of stairs unfold one at a time from the sound of it.
It'd have to be that sound effect.
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. That I like that.
Yeah, and the it unfolded with no faintest creak or clang. So, yeah.
And it sets this tension up nicely. You can imagine everyone sort of stood there staring at this strange opening, waiting for something to happen. But nothing does. Nothing or no one emerges.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice... that flipped my expectation because I was expecting something, you know, because you do, don't you?
Take me to your leader or we have come to whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
We come in peace, yeah. But no. So, you know, being the scientific chaps, they decide to go in. And I thought, again, this was a great little a subversion of my expectation. The door shuts behind them. Wallop. It's a trap.
This is nice. Yeah.
It's a trap.
Yeah.
It is nice because then there's some speculation that perhaps the ship is the being itself.
Yeah.
Which is a cool thing. But also, this is sent exactly as that, just to grab a few of these people and bring them back to Mars, right? So it perfectly worked, sort of sophisticated mousetrap, I suppose.
Indeed, yeah. But again, because, yeah, you do think about that, don't you, about the living thing, because that is such a trope in sci-fi. Mm. I mean, Doctor Who have done it. I'm sure Star Trek has done it at some point. That, you know, the living ship.
Yes.
And everything is kind of like a hive-minded kind of thing, which when you think about it, kind of is in a way.
Well, it is when we find out how it was created. It's interesting to speculate how much of the creator is in the ship, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So we get a nice description of the interior. It was quite roomy and divided into several compartments of ample size, two of which at the vessel centre were lined with low couches covered by soft, lustrous, pileated fabrics of opalescent grey. We get, of course, the usual obscure machinery, and I still feel we're in this slightly steampunk era of dials and levers and whatever.
Yeah, it's pure Jules Verne, isn't it? Because it's rare metals and odd alloys, some of them difficult to classify. There's lots of... I'm seeing lots of brass.
Yes, yes. And flickery dials and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And probably something going... Lots
of valves and steam shooting out of them. Yeah.
And this is then where they get that nice touch. They hear shouting from the outside, feel a sort of movement, and look out to see with some dismay the football field receding below them.
Yeah. I like that. We get another one of Smith's great transitional passages, don't we? Only this, because they're all different, as we've discussed before. And this time it's got a sort of spiral, hasn't it, as it goes.
So, I have to say, it sounds like quite a modern UFO, doesn't it, this?
It does, yeah.
It does sound like it could be from a film today, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is where we get Mr. Stilton, Dr. Stilton, kicking off. This is an outrage, thundered Stilton, as soon as he had recovered a little from his primary surprise There were similar exclamations from other of the same temperament as he, all of whom felt emphatically that something should be done about the situation. Again, it's that thing, isn't it?
Something should be done. Well, what do you suggest exactly?
Take us back this instant.
Yeah, it's a very control sort of thing, isn't it? And he obviously doesn't like not being in control, this guy. But when you think of an intelligence that can create something like this and send it all that way, there's no humility on his part, is there?
No. I like the fact that basically the takeoff has sort of given them, you know, it's given them vertigo kind of things. So they all have to lie on these couches as they're going up. Again, that's sort of, as it's spinning, it's a very visual thing. You can picture it, can't you?
Oh, yeah.
And it's straight out of 50s, 60s sci-fi. People lying on these sort of blocks, you know, it'd be them silver blocks, wouldn't it?
That's like foam.
Yeah, them foam block things. as the camera swooshes around them. Yeah.
And it seems obvious, right, that these couches have been provided expressly for them. So this makes us realise that it's even more of a trap or an enticement or whatever you want to call it. And they're up into space before they know it, and they find that they can start to walk around. Yeah. And initially we had the G-force. Would they have known about G-force then?
It's a good question.
Because people weren't really traveling. I mean, your fastest plane here would have been a couple of hundred miles an hour.
Yeah.
It's not until you get into real high speed
jet engines.
Yeah. I'm not sure at what level you experience G-force.
That's a really good question. I have no idea.
Physics not being our strong point. Perhaps a listener can tell us.
Because
now that's another trope, right? You see people in the craft and the face going.
The face going, yeah. Yeah.
But, of course, once they're up into space, then they feel a lot lighter. You get that weightlessness.
Yeah. The thin, rarefied air as well. And of course, Stilton's even more cheesed off now. He realises he's in space, isn't he? This is damnable. It's contrary to all law, decency and order. The US government should do something about it immediately. I love Gallard's response here. I thought this was a really nice touch. You can just picture him in his tweed with a pipe, maybe. Right. I fear that we are now beyond the jurisdiction of the US. And, well... as well as that of all other mundane governments. So, he's got a point, right?
Yeah, but Stilton won't take this, will he? Absurd, preposterous, outrageous. I've always maintained that space travel was utterly chimerical. Even Earth scientists haven't been able to invent a spaceship. There's that sort of arrogance again. Even Earth scientists. Yeah.
The fact that he continues saying it's ridiculous to assume that highly intelligent life capable of such invention could exist on other planets. Is that human arrogance, isn't it? Mm.
So they search the ship, because the thing is, we've still not seen any sign of any sort of pilots or inhabitants of this craft. So they take the opportunity to search the whole vessel and find no sign of life. They can't even really work out the method of propulsion. It's plainly non-explosive, for there were no roaring and flaming discharge of rockets. All was silent, gliding and vibrationless, with nothing to betoken mechanical activity other than the shifting of the keys and glowing of certain intricate coils and pistons with a strange blue light. And we get a brief mention of radioactivity, which would be slightly worrying.
Indeed.
And Stilton tries to take control of the thing, doesn't he? He grabs some levers.
I like that. The fact that he basically goes up to a bank of keys and jabs one of them, but it's hot, so it burns his finger. That'll teach you.
Yeah. And Gallard is the only one who seems to have made his sand roll here, because Stilton is obviously off on a major strop. Some of the others are less capable of orientating themselves to their bizarre and terrific circumstances. They become pale and horror-stricken with a sense of irredeemable loss, of all-encompassing peril and giddy confusion. They watched the receding earth from whose comfortable purlieus they had been removed so inexplicably and with such awful suddenness. So... definite sand loss there, because everything they know is now down on that little blue speck outside the window.
Yeah, well, this actually struck me as quite topical, because yesterday, for about 2 hours, I think it was, Meta went down, right? So Facebook was knackered, Instagram was knackered, WhatsApp was knackered, and people were panicking, right? people were saying, like, oh, that's how I communicate with people and all the rest of it. So you've taken away that means of people to communicate for even such a brief time, and they didn't know what to do. It's like if you go out and you forget your phone, right?
Yeah.
Because you get so used to these things, and that's exactly what you get here with the reporters, because the reporters aren't so much scared and terrified about the fact they're in space. They're preoccupied with the fact that they can't communicate with the journals they represent.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think was I think that's incredibly well observed, because that's exactly what would happen. How am I supposed to tell the Daily Tribune now?
It is. And then you get very much that same thing with your officials, right? Your mayor and the police chief and all that.
Exactly.
They're in circumstances that nullify completely their civic importance. So, you know, in space, no one, it's not only that no one can hear you scream, no one cares if you scream or not.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody can hear you cut the red tape. Yeah.
And the scientists, as we know, well, we've got these two camps, haven't we? We've got Gallard going, wow, this is
awesome.
Ultra sensational. And, the big cheese going, no, this is all nonsense. Take me back to Earth now. It's all some trick, some illusion.
Yeah. It's an outrage. It's a commie plot. You know, because basically that's the way he's going on this, isn't it? That it's all some kind of plot against him. You know, again, it's that sort of arrogance. Yeah,
yeah. It's very personal, isn't it? Yeah. So they're on this flight for hours. I guess someone has a watch, so they have some measure of passing time, and they start to get hungry. And this is where we get, again, this took me back to Star Trek, you know, you press the button, the panel opens, and there's your three-course meal. And again, it makes me wonder how much Roddenberry had read of Smith. I'm sure that Smith wasn't the first or only person to have that idea, but the more I read of Smith science fiction, the more Star Trek I've seen.
Well, this one, I was getting a lot of the second Peter Cushing Doctor Who movie, Dalek Invasion Earth 2150 AD, because you got the scene with Bernard Cribbins goes on the Dalek flying saucer, and he's pretending to be a robo man, and he's got to use the food machine, and there's all these little bars of food and stuff, and he cocks it up, and you got all these smarties shooting out of it, left, right, and centre. But again, it was a massive trope in the 60s, wasn't it? In 60s sci-fi, these food dispensers. And it was because here we got the food was a sort of reddish paste. And that's exactly what it is. It's all brightly coloured pastes and blocks and bars and pills, isn't it?
It is. And even when you think of things like Tomorrow's World, or when they were looking at the sort of the space journey and NASA and all that, it was all this idea that in the future we'd be eating pills. I suppose in a sense we are, in that people take lots of vitamins and supplements and all those kind of things now. But, you know, you still can't beat a big plate of chips, can you?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like even in the early Doctor Who, it might be like the third serial, I think, called The Edge of Destruction. Which was basically it was set entirely in the TARDIS because of budget constraints, and so it was just the four leads, and you were introduced to how people ate on the TARDIS, and again it was this thing, but it was like Susan said to Ian, "What do you want? Oh, I fancy a roast beef dinner," and he got this bar,
right,
and he's like, "Oh, potatoes, oh, Yorkshire pudding." You know, with each bite, you got a different flavour.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, you can go, what they call it, is it MREs, the military rations, those dehydrated things and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, some people buy in vast quantities and store in their bunkers.
Oh, yeah. Your preppers. Yeah. Pot noodles. There you go. That's the way forward.
Abomination. So it soon becomes obvious that they're heading for Mars, the red world, with its familiar markings, which they had watched so often through observatory telescopes, and over whose character and causation they had long puzzled, began to loom before them and swelled upon the heavens with thaumaturgic swiftness. See, it's still Smith, isn't it? You still get those nice little phrases, thaumaturgic swiftness.
And again, you get another outburst from Stilton. Outrageous, unheard of, ludicrous.
What does it take?
He's such a killjoy, isn't he, this chap?
Oh, no. He's a real party people. Yeah. Just go with the flow, man. Just go with it.
I'd have knocked him out by now. Stop moaning.
What are you saying? Where's the airlock?
Yeah, exactly. Put him in the airlock. Yeah, done a Captain Volmar on him. Yeah. Off your pop, pal. Yeah.
Now, of course, everyone knows that Mars has canals on it, right? But here we get the discovery as the craft comes lower down to the surface that the true nature of the canal, it's not water, as many had hereforeto presumed, but a mass of pale green vegetation, of vast and serrate leaves or fronds, all of which seem to emanate from a single crawling flesh-coloured stalk. Which is a nice idea, you know. That's a, again, he could have gone with the obvious. Yeah, everyone knows Mars canals, but no, he's gone for something quite smitten.
Yeah, I do love the descriptions here of this, because even at the end of the same paragraph you get this lovely bit about the swollen nodular joints at half mile intervals. Aside from this anomalous and super gigantic vine, there was no trace of life, either animal or vegetable, in the whole landscape, and the extent of the crawling stalk, which netted the entire visible terrain, but seemed by its form and characteristics to be the mere tendril of some vaster growth, was a thing to stagger the preconceptions of mundane botany.
Nice.
That's the Smith, isn't it? You know, any other writer would have said there was a walloping great plant.
Yeah. With bits
spreading out for miles.
It was very big. Yeah.
Mundane botany, that could be a band name. That'd be like a folk trio. Yeah.
Folk trio. Yeah.
An experimental folk trio from Devon. There you go.
Whacked out on cider.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and Stilton is still saying, outrageous, unheard of, ludicrous. This thing defies the most elementary laws of botany. There is no conceivable precedent for it, but there it is, right in front of you. You get the feeling, I mean, Smith is having a pop here at this type, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And this now is descending into sort of this guy being manic, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Is losing it. This is a rational sort of view of what's going on, or an assessment of the situation. He's just lost it, I think.
Well, it reminds me, like, I think, again, it's quite prescient to the modern world, because he'd be the sort of guy, the sort of expert that you get popping up on YouTube videos telling you that all these wacky conspiracy theories,
right? Yeah,
wouldn't
he? Yeah.
You know, he's exactly that type, that even presented with the actual, like, there it is. It's in front of you. You can touch it. We'd still go, no, 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 no. It's all a trick. It's it's all lies. It's fake news, you know.
Absolutely. So, yeah, Smith was being quite prescient in that respect. But then perhaps they had exactly the same thing back in those days. But
Tinfoil Hat Brigade's been around for as long as, you know.
I suppose then it was just raging in newspaper columns and, you know, the letters column of weird tales and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So they get to have a good look at this. And then the vessel starts to move again, this time in a lateral direction. It follows the course of the creeper to what seemed to be the west of Mars. I'm not sure how they work out. It's I suppose if they know where the pole is, I guess that's how you'd work that out. Above which a small and pallid sun was descending through the dingy, burnt-out sky and casting a thin, chilly light athwart the desolate land. So that's all there is living on this version of Mars, is just this huge vine-like thing. There's no sign of any other life at all. But they get this sense of an intelligent determination behind all that was occurring, and the sense of this remote, unknowable supervision and control was stronger in Gallard even than in the others. So maybe because he's open to the weird or the unexplained, he is more sensitive to the the presence of whatever is controlling this situation. Yeah.
I like the fact that, that Gallard is using this wisely this time, because it basically says here that he, the, as it's slowing down, he was using the opportunity for study of their new environment, and in particular for observation of the growth itself. So while Stilton's off shaking his fist at this guy and ranting and raving, Gallard's actually sitting there with his notebook going, right, it's a plan, and it seems to be going here and there and there. So
Is actually observing, yeah. And I thought this was nice. I wasn't sure where this was going at first. It actually didn't go in the direction I thought it might. They travel an immense territory, and the sandy desolation yields to more of a swamp with sluggish water. And here too, the foliage assumed a richer and more vivid greenness, fraught with sublime vital exuberance, and the stem itself displayed an indescribable succulence, together with a shining and glossy luster, a bloom that was weirdly and incongruously suggestive of well-nourished flesh. The thing seemed to palpitate at regular intervals. So this is almost as much animal as it is plant, from the sound of it. And I thought succulent flesh, we're getting a sense of, well, what is this thing feeding on? That was my first thought here. I thought, are they going to be dinner kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, you instantly sort of think of the crinoids from Doctor Who or Triffids or something like that, don't you? When you get this sort of plant-like organism, even the original thing, you know, the big carrot thing from, Thing in Another World. But again, Stilton, somebody needs to give him a right slap. Humph, said Stilton. That palpitation is altogether impossible. There must be something wrong with our eyes. No, there's something wrong with you, pal.
And Gallard starts to explain it. There's nothing to say that, you know, the laws in operation on our world, why would you think they apply to another world? Perhaps something on another world can be plant and animal at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that this was quite disturbing, this sense of the stalk splits at certain points. There's like joints in it, and it gives the impression almost of hips. I don't know why I found that quite a creepy thought.
Yeah. And, I like this as well, that one of the reporters sort of works it out. Like, my God, the thing surrounds the entire planet. So you get this sort of sense of scale of this thing now, with all its jointed limbs. It's almost, like a tick or something, right?
Yeah.
And it's obviously been sucking the nutrient out of the planet and all that.
Oh, yeah. Which I guess is why the planet is dead, right?
Exactly.
It's feeding on the planet itself. Yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah, because it says about the marshy region being doubtless the residual ooze of a sunken sea.
Right.
The implication being that old Planty has drunk it, basically.
It sucked Mars dry, and now it's looking for fresh sustenance.
Exactly, yeah. Mm.
And we get one of those great Smith panoramic views, which he does quite a lot. I mean, in the last story with the singing flame, we had it where you get taken up and get this huge panoramic view of what's going on below. The vessel soared to a great height, and they looked down on the realm-wide expanse of leafage. In its middle, they discerned a circular node, leagues in extent, and rising like a rounded alp, from which emanated in all directions the planet-circling stems of the weird growth. And we get this description of, it was like the head of some gargantuan cuttlefish, and the stalks that ran away on all sides were suggestive of tentacles.
Oh, yes. There we go.
We had Cyclopean last time, and we've got tentacles this time. Great.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and I've got another great Smith line here. The whole plant palpitated like a breathing bosom. He can't help himself, can he?
My word. And this sort of setup, and he describes these sort of lakes of these two masses in the centre of the head. It almost gives the sense of a face, doesn't it? Two eyes and a face. This is the head of the creature. So the vessel now begins to descend and settles down in a valley close to the mountainer's head. They come out of the ship, and I expect they're quite relieved to find that the Martian air differs very little from that which they had been breathing in the space flyer, and the temperature was moderately warm. I'm not quite sure how accurate that is.
No. Have you ever seen Total Recall?
Oh, yes, of course.
The eye bulging scene, yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Close at hand there rose the vast flesh-coloured wall of the central plant head, which sloped upward like a hill toward the hidden eyes and was no doubt deeply embedded and rooted in the Martian soil. And even it's like they're walking on this thing. Its surface was netted with millions of wrinkle-like reticulations and was filled with great pores resembling those of animal skin beneath some extra-powerful microscope. So this is a huge entity, a huge being. And it's almost like they've been reduced now to the size of sort of microorganisms or something. Or it's like they're the little ticks now.
Indeed. Yeah. And again, you get this lovely little thing here, this implication, because underfoot, resilient soil, completely devoid of grass, lichens, fungi, or any minor plant forms. Basically, the only life is this gigantic plant. So the implication to me is that old Planty has eaten everything.
And this is where I'm not sure if it's the mayor or the police chief. I think it's the mayor pipes up now because he wants to know who's in charge here. Where's the US consulate?
Yeah, it's the mayor.
I want to speak to someone in charge.
Yeah. I wonder where the local government hangs out, is the line. Who the hell is in power here anyway? Hey, Gallard, you astronomers know a lot about Mars. Ain't there a US consulate somewhere in this godforsaken hole? So that's satire. Yeah.
It is. Oh, yeah, it is. It is Smith having a pop at that type of person again. But also, in another way, I can't help but thinking that as part of the sand loss, you know, you can't cope with this reality other than by transferring it into your reality, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, again, that's something you see a lot in weird fiction, isn't it? These people, when they're presented with these weird and wonderful, wacky situations, they fall back on their skills, their learning. So yeah, it makes sense. A scientist like Gallard will start studying, right? Because that's what he knows to do, second nature to him. So yeah, he gets somebody like a mayor. What's he going to do?
He's gonna it's trying to frame it in his own
terms.
It's totally that. And Gallard makes the point, well, you want to know who's in charge. I think this is what's in charge. I think we've found who's in charge.
Yeah.
And actually, I thought this next bit was nice because as they look around closer at this thing, they find these certain peculiar outgrowths, either shrunken or vestigial, like drooping and flaccid horns. They were large as a man's body and might at some time have been much larger. And it seems as though the plant has put these things out from some unknown purpose. But then they notice there's a lot of what appear to be tools and ingots and sheets of the same material that the UFO was constructed from. So these appendages were put out in order to build the spaceship.
Yeah. Yeah. Uncanny suggestion of semi-human parts and members, half arms and half tentacles, as if they had been modelled from some exemplar of undiscovered Martian animal life. So, yeah, it has got a sort of mimicry thing going on. That's where the body snatchers thing came to me.
Mm.
You know, the pods and all that. Because, you know, in a couple of paragraphs, we get exactly that, don't we?
Yes. And then we get another very typical response, right? Because here we have Philip Colton, who is an astronomer with a sideline in botany, and he decides to take his penknife out of his pocket and cut one of the leaves off.
I love this. And he gets walloped. Get out of it. At first touch of the keen blade, the whole frond recoiled violently beyond his reach, and then swinging back, it dealt him a tremendous blow, which stretched him on the ground and hurled the knife from his fingers to a considerable distance. I can just hear it. You go, whap! You know?
And again, it's an incredibly stupid thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
You might think, oh, it's just a plant, but then you can't take anything for granted. You're not quite sure what it is. So, of course, any organism anywhere in the universe, I would imagine, if you try and cut it open, it's going to respond in some way.
Yeah. Well, there's the classic thing, like Billy Connolly's to put their hands in holes and they get stung by a thing or pinched by things. And they're like, oh, you bastard. It's like, no, it's not a bastard. That's its house. If somebody put their hand through my window, I'd jab it with a fork.
Absolutely. And Gallard kind of, I can almost see him here sort of edging away from the others, right?
Yeah.
He's not going to take part in any of the discussion that's going on. He prefers his own thoughts and conjectures, continues to watch the throbbing growth.
Oh.
And he's kind of sort of piecing together what's going on here. It's coming to a conclusion.
Yeah, I've got to say, every time he mentioned throbbing growth, my brain went to the gutter.
Well, it's going to go to the gutter even more in a bit.
Yeah, it is.
Because we now get the development of knobs.
Bulbous knobs.
Bulbous knobs. The thing grew like something in a slow-moving picture, lengthening out and swelling visibly with a bulbous knob at the end. This knob soon became a large, faintly convoluted mass whose outlines puzzled and tantalized Gallard with their intimation of something he had once seen but could not now remember. I mean, knob gags aside, this is very thing, isn't it?
It is.
It's almost like it's trying to copy their form or their shape. But that interesting comment about something he faintly remembered, what do you think that's a reference to?
I don't know, because after a few minutes, it sort of starts to resemble a human fetus, doesn't it?
Yes. And we get this woolly floss appearing around the trunk, arms and legs. And it sort of develops into a human shape with clothing on it.
Yeah, because it spins a cocoon around it, doesn't it, sort of thing.
Yeah. So, again, this is very cinematic, I think.
Yeah. It's body snatchers or killer clowns from outer space with their candy floss cocoons.
Yeah. And much to Gallard's dismay and horror, when the thing is fully formed, it's a replica of himself. Which, like you say, classic body snatchers, though it still has a thick tendril that attaches it to the main being. The tendril issued from the base of the brain like an oddly misplaced umbilical cord. So, yeah, he's a little bit shocked by this appearance of the doppelganger, as he describes it. And the figure raised its right hand and seemed to beckon to him. Gallard went slowly forward till he and his miraculous double stood face to face. Then the strange being placed its hand on his brow. It seems though a mesmeric spell was laid upon him from that moment. Almost without his own volition, for a purpose he was not yet permitted to understand, he began to speak. And the figure, imitating his every tone and cadence, repeated the words after him. So it's mimicked the physical form, and it wouldn't necessarily know that clothes are clothes, right? That's just how these things look. And now you get the feeling it's learnt the language. So, well, I suppose Gallard hopes it's getting ready to communicate with him rather than replace him.
Well, yeah. You get this lovely moment here again. I'm picturing plant monsters in tweed now. Dazed and exhausted, Gallard realised that the long lesson was over, for the being removed its hand from his brow and addressed him in scholarly, well-modulated English. Because of my brain and growing up watching the BBC back in the day, right? I'm hearing it in RP.
Absolutely.
It's got to be an RP, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. I have learned all I need to know for the purposes of linguistic communication.
So, yeah, his double explains that the being through whom I speak, made in the likeness of one of your own, is a mere special organ which I have developed so that I could communicate with you. I, the informing entity, who combine in myself the utmost genius and energy of those two divisions of life which are known to you as the plant and the animal, I, who possess the virtue, omniety, and immortality of a god, have had no need of articulate speech or formal language at any previous time in my existence. So this thing, as we surmised, is a plant and animal at the same time, but way beyond that, describes itself as a god.
Yeah, I like that. I thought that was it's a plant with ideas above its station. I like it. But yeah, and he goes on to explain that it be constructed with other special organs that put forth for this purpose, the space flyer that descended upon your planet and then returned to me a delegation. The building of the flyer and its mode of control will be made plain when I tell you that I am the master of many cosmic forces beyond the rays and energies known to Tellurian savants. These forces I can draw from the air, the soil, or the ether at will, or can even summon from remote stars and nebulae.
Cosmic.
Yeah, exactly. So he basically formed it out of any sort of matter. Yeah. You know, it's quite impressive.
And this is where this thing lays out a deal now for them.
Yep.
Because as we surmised earlier, it's pretty much drained Mars dry. But with its sensory powers, it's seen that the Earth, of course, one thing the Earth has got a lot of is water.
Yep.
So you think, well, this thing could just go to Earth and take it over, right? It seems to have the power to do that. But it actually offers, in return for having some water from Earth, I'll teach you all this amazing stuff, how to colonize other planets, how to explore the universe, how to overcome your social imperfections, how to master your planetary environment. Basically, it's going to give them all the secrets of life, the universe, and everything in exchange for a bit of a drink.
Indeed. Yeah, because he explains that he has no need of companionship with other entities because he's basically an omnipotent god plant. But that with my two giant eyes, which possess an optic magnifying power beyond that of your strongest telescopes, I have studied Earth and the other planets during the Martian nights, and I've learned much regarding the conditions that exist upon each. And he goes on to say that, yeah, your history and all the rest of it, you lot are a bunch of idiots. You're ruining your planet. You're a bunch of morons. You keep fighting wars. I'm not happy about it. So we'll stop that. Give me some water and I'll tell you how to make everything groovy.
And we'll sort it all out. Yeah. Which feeds into that sort of cosmic savior trope, doesn't it?
Indeed.
Which, again, the day the Earth stood still was one example of that.
Yeah.
And it seems to be the aliens either come to destroy us or save us in all those old movies.
Yeah.
Now, this is really sets the tone for the rest of the story, because what this does, as might be expected, splits the party in half, right?
Yeah.
Gallard almost straight away, yes, is well up for this. What an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
And as might be expected, Stilton and some of the other, the dogmatists, as they're described.
Indeed.
Were emphatically and even rabidly opposed and declined to consider the Martians' offer for an instant, because it would be highly undesirable and improper.
Yeah. It would never do for the nations of Earth to involve themselves in an entanglement of such questionable nature, or to hold commerce of any sort with a being such as the plant monster, which had no rightful biological status.
Oh, there's you could unpack a lot in there.
Couldn't
right?
you just? Yeah.
Status.
Especially the time period it was written.
Yes.
Yeah. There's quite a lot of satire, and a lot of it is biting, and I approve.
Yeah. It's really speaking to that, that notion of superiority of certain types over others, isn't it?
Yeah.
But just also that sort of denigration of the thing. It's a plant monster.
Yeah.
It's a god, in effect. It's just told you it's omniscient and it's all-seeing and remarkably powerful.
But yeah.
It's just a plant monster. You get the feeling if they could here, they'd have the torches and the axes out, right? They'd be hacking away at this.
Like, I just think it's very telling that the fact that one of their biggest arguments is the fact that it's not being classified. It's if your name's not down, you're not coming in.
No hats, no trainers.
Exactly.
No stalks or knobs. And we get this little mention here, because not only do the dogmatists disagree, they denounce Gallard and the other pro-Martians as virtual traitors to humanity and intellectual Bolshevists whose ideas were dangerous to the integrity of human thought.
Mm.
Well, what I'm reading into that is any authority that Stilton and co. have is totally wiped away by this thing. You know, we're talking about that ego and arrogance again. So,
yeah.
They're just looking to protect their own very small interests in the face of what potentially could be the saving of mankind or humankind.
Yeah, definitely.
And let's face it, this thing could, a flick of a tentacle, just wipe them all out. I mean, He's being remarkably patient.
It's more patience than I have. And I just go, right, you guys are cool. So, because he makes a little shelter for them out of like these leaves and stuff, doesn't he? Which just sounds quite idyllic, really. Quite sort of tropical. You know, it's almost like a Hawaiian beach hut or something, right? So you guys go off in there. You lot. Wallop. See you later.
Yeah, and again, this is another one of those lovely Smith descriptions. The Earthmen saw that the flyer was brilliantly illuminated, pouring out a gorgeous amethystine radiance from its violet ports. Then beneath the foliage close at hand, they perceived another and stranger luminosity, which seemed to be emitted like some sort of radioactive or noctilucent glow by the great leaves themselves. And we get ewers of liquid and platters of food on low tables, and the air was gentle as that of a spring night in a subtropic land. So, as you say, completely paradisical. And this thing has just done this like that, you know, a click of the fingers. Again, this kind of put me in mind of Star Trek, things like the Squire of Gothos, where everything was made by this being's imagination, incredibly powerful being who's able to make thoughts into reality.
Nice. Yeah.
And the other lot, they stand outside. They don't want to come in. They're standing there shivering in the cold. And eventually it gets so cold, they have to come into this nice little area.
Oh, no. I think the scary thing about this story is this is exactly what would have happened and would still happen. If this happened to a bunch of people, you would get this, wouldn't you?
Yeah, there's always going to be your denier. There's going to be the people who deny the reality of what's going on. And there's always going to be any opportunity is viewed with suspicion. You know, I suppose we could say, to be fair, in a sense, perhaps they think, is this thing trying to trick us in some way?
Well, that's fair enough. You'd be cautious, yeah, but don't be a close-minded dick. You know,
but it seems to have so much power, yeah, that it just seems to me it could. I'd be asking the question: Why does it need us? You know, it can't get on this spaceship itself. It needs us to go back to Earth to do something, I guess.
Yeah, man, it's rooted in the planet, isn't it? It's kind of stuck where it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose there is that, but nonetheless, Gallard seems to be of the mind that this is a great opportunity rather than a threat. So essentially they head back to Earth. They're put back onto the spaceship and are sent back to Earth. And their reappearance doesn't really allay any fears. And when they describe what happened, it seems to stoke up these fears to an even greater pitch, not helped by Stilton and his fellow conservatives, who create with their pronouncements a globe-wide wave of anti-Martian prejudice, of blind opposition and dogmatic animosity. And we even get, we got the scientists involved in this, because a lot of scientists side with Stilton, but then the religions get involved as well, because they say, well, this God thing, this is obviously blasphemy.
Yeah. The impiety of such claims and the menace of a non-anthropomorphic god and type of worship that might be introduced on Earth could not be tolerated for a moment. So, but it actually managed to do something that, you know, heretofore never happened. It unites all these religions against it.
There is
for the first time. They agree on something, you know.
Interesting speculation there about, you know, disclosure and all that kind of stuff. And further than that, so we've got science, we've got religion, and now we get commercial interests as well, because the political powers felt that there might be something Bolshevistic behind the offer of the Martian to promote a utopian state of society. And the financial, commercial and manufacturing interests likewise thought that it might imply a threat to their welfare or stability. Because this takes us back to the idea of Star Trek again. That's why there's no money in Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Because you've got free energy, you can transport anywhere. If you want some food, you press a button. You know, there's no bills to pay.
Yeah.
It is utopian in that sense.
Indeed. Yeah.
I guess another aspect of this that we could look at if we're thinking in Lovecraftian terms is the idea of a Nyarlathotep, you know, this alien being comes with this promise of technological advancement and a potential utopia. But you don't get the same feeling from this as you do from reading Nyarlathotep, for example.
No. I mean, I'd say it was closer to the Elder Things, really.
Oh, yeah.
Closer to the Elder Things in mountains, you know, because, I mean, they were kind of benevolent, really. They weren't evil creatures. They were just stupid and created Shoggoths. Which rebelled.
This disagreement becomes huge and basically leads to a war on Earth. The internecine warfare that ensued was the most terrible in human history. Class became divided against class, family against family. Newer, more lethal gases than any heretofore employed were devised by chemists, and whole cities or territories were smothered beneath their agonizing pull.
Yeah.
So we've got this hugely destructive, well, he doesn't say nuclear, but we've got gas and then extremely powerful weapons. Half the planet is blasted out of existence. The pro-Martians are gravely outnumbered, scattered. You've got Gallard flying around in a space vessel, helping them out, instructing them in the use of new weapons and cosmic energies. They seem to be losing against the dogmatists.
Yeah, he starts to panic, doesn't he? But then the plant monster sort of whisks them away, doesn't he, old plant lord?
Mm.
And in my infinite wisdom, my supreme foreprescience, I have removed you from the hopeless struggle to establish on Earth the sovereign light and truth which I offer. And this is where basically he shows his strength, doesn't he? Because he just sort of, I've had enough of this now. You lot are being idiots. Yeah, yeah. And he sends a seed.
Yes.
The titular seed.
The titular seed. That sounds like, should be the title of someone. Yeah. Like the venerable bead.
Venerable bead.
The titular,
yeah. Titular seed.
And nice. I like the fact that he sent all these little spaceships to rescue his supporters on Earth, wherever they were, because they're scattered all over the place. Some of them holding out, you can almost picture them. There's 10 of them left against the surrounding armies. They'll get taken up into space and this big fleet gathers. And they're going to be off to Venus soon, as we'll discover.
Yeah. I thought I liked these passages now where you got the seed. It sort of plunked. It was in India, isn't it? It sort of comes down and then it just opens and out comes the vines and it just spreading and just decimating the planet. Just wallop.
Yeah, it's like this creeping death, and it releases this narcotic gas, doesn't it, as it goes?
It does, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think it's described as euthanizes people, doesn't it? Which
indeed, it does. Yeah,
very sort of technical term, isn't it?
Yeah, it's also quite chilling.
Yes,
the usage of it.
It's dispassionate, isn't it? You
indeed, scientific, clinical.
Yeah, that's the word, clinical. Yeah. And meanwhile, the pro-Martians are taken to Venus, which, again, as is so often the case at this time, is the tropical Venus, right? The Jurassic Venus.
I thought this was a bit harsh, though, because he breaks out the death rays and wipes out all the indigenous reptilian life. I thought that was a bit harsh.
Yeah, I suppose you've got to make space for the human. Well, isn't that typical of humans, though? Wherever we go, everything else suffers.
Exactly.
And of course, they've got all this super knowledge now, the humans on Venus. So it doesn't matter that there's highly pernicious bacteria peculiar to Venus, because they can cope with them with their new scientific knowledge. They became the lords of a salubrious climate, dowered with 4 mild and equable seasons by the slight annual rotation of the planet, but having one eternal day like the mythic isles of the blessed beneath a low and undeparting sun. And Gallard becomes leader naturally, and he keeps this close rapport with the plant lord. It's almost like he's the high priest now, isn't it?
Yeah, because he does actually mention that the pro-plant people come to worship it as the god that it is. So, yeah, it is very much so like the high priest mouthpiece. And the great forests were cleared in many places, cities of lofty and ethereal architecture, lovely as those of some transstellar Eden, builded by the use of force beams, began to rear their graceful turrets and majestic cumuli of domes above the gigantic calamites and ferns. That brings to mind one of those lovely cover illustrations that you got on like the Panther editions of Smith.
Oh yes,
yes,
the Bruce Pennington, absolutely. And not only is it physically an attractive place, it's a utopian society dedicated to cosmic progress, scientific knowledge, spiritual tolerance and freedom. a happy law-abiding nation, blessed with millennial longevity and exempt from sorrow and disease and error. Meanwhile on Earth...
Yeah, I love this.
Oh, and just one other thing there. They do manage to set up this interplanetary sort of communication where they can take water from Venus and send it to Mars to replenish the dehydrated air there. So the plant god gets its sustenance.
Yeah.
Yes, but Earth, as you said, we've got this vinery, this rampant vinery.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah, you know, basically it nets the whole globe, for the seas offered little or no barrier to its full-grown stems and tendrils. When the process of growth was complete, the anti-Martian moiety of the human race had joined the uncouth monsters of prehistoric time in that limbo of oblivion to which all superseded and outdated genera have gone.
Nice. That was my album name, Limbo of Oblivion. I thought that.
No, that's a great one. Yeah.
And Stilton is still there.
Of course he is. I love the ending. Yeah.
It was great that we've got Gallard in his Venusian
paradise.
Utopia,
yeah.
In his paradise, probably sipping on a daiquiri.
And then you got Stilton in his frozen Antarctic hell, basically.
Yeah. They fled in a rocket ship to the Antarctic plateau. Here, as they were congratulating themselves on their escape, they saw far off on the horizon the rearing of the swift stems, beneath whose foliage the ice and snow appeared to melt away in rushing torrents. Now, you might think they get overtaken by the leaves and that narcotic gas.
Nope.
But no, because the torrents become a diluvial sea in which the last dogmatists were drowned. Only in this way did they elude the euthanasia of the great leaves, which had overtaken all their fellows.
Yeah, basically a biblical flood, isn't it? It's,
It is, yeah, yeah.
And you get that sort of divine wrath feeling from it, don't you? This plant god.
Well, actually, now you say that, yeah, if you think back to the biblical flood, then that was a cleansing of the earth. It was like, oh, it's all gone a bit wrong. Let's control-delete.
Yeah, cleansing the sinners, yeah.
I'll have a word with Noah. Look, you know, get your family on board this, gather all the animals together, and then everyone else is gone.
Whereas they were on an ark and that lot were off to Venus.
Which, yeah,
there is a definite parallel.
Yeah. So, yes, I think, you know, on the one end, we can say, yeah, Smith had a story brief and he stuck to it and he put several of his own elements into it. But again, as always, you can dig a little deeper with Smith, and certainly that satirical element is there in this.
Yeah. You tend to find that he does a lot of his satire in these science fiction stories. Some of it did make me chuckle, some of the satire in this. Just because it's still... You know, it's still relevant.
Well, I think, yeah, your point with like the religions there and everything, nothing brings people together more than an outside threat.
Exactly.
You know, and this is something truly outside. Yeah, so there's lots you could speculate on there. And I think, well, I mean, you could get into climate change and climate denial and all those sort of areas as well, really, in that sense.
Of course, yeah.
And I still think at the end of the day, it's obvious that the plant thing could have just wiped Earth out anyway and worried about the water later.
Yeah.
So it did seem genuine in its intentions.
Yeah. Well, it could have sent a couple of them seeds down to right at the start, couldn't it? Instead of a spaceship. Mm. But he gave us a chance and we blew it. It doesn't have to say it all.
So there we are. The Seedling of Mars. Let us know what you think, dear listener. Some interesting potential questions raised there, I think.
Mm.
When it comes to the letters, we don't really have very much. It was mentioned in passing in one or two places. You gave that little extract earlier. I just want to read the paragraph from that. Because this is Smith writing to Lovecraft this time. I guess because of the way the letters were kept or whatever, most of the letters in the book are Lovecraft to Smith. So it's nice to see Smith to Lovecraft. And it's nice to see Smith employing one of our wonderful return addresses.
Oh, excellent. Here we go. Yeah, that's interesting, because in the one I've got, Eccentric Impractical Devils with Derleth, most of the letters are from Smith.
Yeah.
And there's very few from Derleth. So that's strange. Yeah, it must just be how they were stored.
So this is early August 1931. At the opening on Eros of the time vault that conducts upon former eons, when Eros was part of the major planet Antonoth, which revolved between Mars and Jupiter. Dear H. Pyle.
Nice.
Last month was certainly a busy one for me with the forest fire et al. Then, along about the 15th, I received a letter from the Wonder Stories editor enclosing a plot that had taken second prize in the quarterly's plot contest. You may have noticed the details in the issue I sent you, asking me to make a story out of it. The plot, called The Martian by one E.M. Johnson of Ontario, was pretty good, so the job wasn't so disagreeable as it sounds. They wanted the story for the full quarterly out September the 15th, so I had to write and retype the whole yarn, about 16,000 words, in little more than a week, so that it could reach New York by the end of July. I hope it will pass muster. It ought to be a pretty fair science fictional opus. So there we go. Like you say, a week. That's pretty good going. 16,000 words finished in a week. That is pretty good going.
It's not bad. Yeah, not bad at all. Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't find any letters in Wonder Stories about it, because obviously it was in the quarterly, not the main magazine, and there's no letters in the quarterly. I did look in the issues after it had been released, and there was mentions of the quarterly, full quarterly, but they were just general, just basically people saying, oh, it was a really good, it was cracking read. There was nothing specific about Smith's story.
Now, speaking of letters, we have had a letter come in about our last story, Beyond the Singing Flame, and it's from Kerry O'Brien in Kansas, USA.
Yep, Kerry says, thank you for the eximious episode of Strange Shadows covering Beyond the Singing Flame. I thought you might be interested to know that City of the Singing Flame was included in a 1949 anthology by August Derleth titled The Other Side of the Moon, which also included stories by Lovecraft, Wandry et al.
Nice use of the word eximious there. And a review in the Chicago Tribune from May the 8th, 1949 reads, of the individual stories, Clark Ashton Smith's magnificent The City of the Singing Flame, an atmospheric tale of Earth's jumping-off place, deserves special mention.
Yep, and Kerry goes on to say that the cover artwork of the 1956 British edition depicts Hastain's arrival in the new dimension as he steps through the greenish-grey columns with the forest of purple vegetation, a massive red city in the distance. An image of the cover is attached for your examination.
Thanks, Kerry. And that's a very nice cover. That we'll put a link up to that in the notes below.
Awesome.
So, yeah, thanks a lot for sending that in, Harry. And as always, we're grateful to hear from any of our listeners. If you have any ideas, suggestions, corrections of pronunciations, any decent puns, knob gags, anything like that, then do feel free to send it in. Of course, you can leave comments on our YouTube page, our Facebook page. You can send us an email at innsmouthbookclub@outlook.com. I'm finding at the moment, I don't know about you, Tim, but I've got like, I think 10 email addresses.
Oh, mate, yeah.
I've got a few Facebook accounts. I'm on several WhatsApp groups. I do struggle at times to keep up with all the communication.
I totally get that. Yeah, the last count, I think about 12 email addresses or something ridiculous.
So I do apologise if we miss, because I did notice there was a direct message on the Patreon site, which you can do now, apparently. Ooh. And that had been sitting there for a couple of weeks.
I didn't know you could do that, that's why.
So I do apologise if there is a delay in responding. But anyway, we're always grateful to hear from you. And of course, we're grateful to all our patrons. If you'd like to join them and help support the show, please check out our Patreon site for details of our levels of membership. So That's all for this week. We hope you enjoyed that episode and that story. What have we got lined up next time, sir?
Well, I believe, speaking of patrons, that we're going to go with a Patreon episode, aren't we? A bonus episode.
Yes. So this is one of the benefits you get if you join as a member. You get access to bonus episodes, not only for Strange Shadows, but also for the Innsmouth Book Club as well. So what we thought we'd do is leave this open to our patrons to decide. If you'd like to give us a topic, now that could be something to do with the letters between Smith and Lovecraft and Derleth. It could be about Smith's poetry. You might have some particular questions about Smith's life or themes of his work. Basically, anything you'd like to hear us to talk about, then let us know in the next sort of week or so, and we'll record that next time as a patron episode.
Then after that, we will be back with our next story in the main sort of the main flow, which is one I've been looking forward to, and I know you have as well. It's The Vaults of Yeovambis.
Oh, that's a favourite. That really is an amazing story. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Thanks again for listening, folks. With that, it's goodbye from me, Rob Poynton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.